Schneider Electric is proud to bring this podcast to you. Schneider's mission is to be the customer's digital partner for sustainability and efficiency. And bringing insights such as you are about to hear helps further that mission.
So I'd like to welcome you to the latest installment of the AWA podcast, as well as the next installment in the IWA Australia Thought Leadership Series. My name is Michael Story, and I'd like to kick off today by firstly acknowledging the traditional owners of the lands on which we meet today. I'm joining you from Gadigal land, which is one of the Eora Nation, which is one of 500 First Nations of Australia. I'd like to pay my respects to Gadigal Nation elders past and present, and also acknowledge their continuing and unbroken connection to our lands and waterways, and thank them for their custodianship and care of our ecosystem since time immemorial. Just to give you a bit of context, the IWA Australia, it's a branch committee of the Australian Water Association. We exist to represent the interests of the International Water Association in Australia, and conversely, also to represent the interests of the Australian Water Association globally, and to put a lot of the great work that's done locally on a global stage. And no better example of this is the work that we've led with alongside Professor Tony Wong over this last year, and looking into smart and resilient cities. We're delighted to be joined by Tony for this podcast. Tony, welcome.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Excellent. It's great to see you again. Tony is a civil engineer, has PhD in water resource engineering, and is internationally recognised for his research and practice in sustainable urban water management, particularly in sustainable urban design. Tony's a fellow of the Australian Academy of Technology and Engineering, and Tony's worked globally in consulting, research and academia. In 2012, Tony led the establishment of the Cooperative Research Centre for Water Sensitive Cities, and here he brought together over 80 partner organisations across seven industry and government sectors. In 2018, Tony received the IWA Global Water Award for his leadership and lifetime achievements in developing the concept of water-sensitive urban design. I can't think of a greater thought leader in this area, and we're privileged to have Tony here in Australia and here with us today to talk around water-sensitive cities. I'm also pleased to say that Tony's just returned from COP28 in Dubai, and Tony will share some of his reflections and insights that he's gleaned from his experience in Dubai just earlier this month. So, Tony, it's great to have you. So, talk to us, water-sensitive cities. We met with a number of other thought leaders, and we learned that it meant different things to different peoples. Just bring it to life. What is a smart and resilient water-sensitive city?
Yeah, look, thank you, Michael, for the invitation to have this chat with you. Delighted to do so. My interest and work in cities really stem from the notion that the cities are, you know, a melting pot of so many challenges and issues that we face with. It's not specifically about water, it's not specifically about housing, but many factors do come together to ultimately define the sustainability, resilience, and livability of cities. So I'm not surprised that many of us may have different perspectives of what resilient means or what smart mean for that matter. In fact, depending on who you talk to and the discipline they come from, they will all have different perspective, all important perspective of what makes a city resilient, sustainable, smart, and livable. My particular expertise, as you mentioned, is in the water sector. And of course, I will focus on some of my reflection related to water. And water is ubiquitous in almost every aspect of how we see a city operate, and therefore underpins or enable a lot of our initiatives for creating sustainable, resilient, livable cities. Our ability to harness that and integrate the way we manage water is in itself a smart initiative. And some could argue, as I would, that that is perhaps the first definition of what a smart city is its ability to manage the various challenges and facets of water management. And there are plenty. As we look at climate impact, for instance, in our cities, you find that water is manifested in drought, in floods, in deteriorating water quality, impacting on our food security, influencing the microclimate of our cities, just to name a few. And you find that because of that, the need to bring together so many different skill sets in water management and then integrating those skill sets into other disciplines that define urban planning, urban transport, water resource management, water chemistry, and all of those other disciplines fundamentally underpin ultimately what how resilient a city would be, how sustainable, and how smart it will be. So I think I'll start with that sort of reflection. And in the previous seminar, we've heard certain aspects of that. You know, we heard the perspective, for instance, of the challenges faced by a water utility in a small island developing states context, in this case in Fiji. Dr. Channon was invited to present his thoughts and the challenges faced by small island development states are, again, multifaceted. Rising sea level being a huge impact, highly dispersed communities across multiple islands could actually affect the whole efficiency and cost effectiveness of delivering essential water services. Coastal protection of properties and assets are becoming issues that are occupying many small island development states. And of course, increasing level of saltwater intrusion into the water supply of small island states, both in terms of groundwater or even in terms of the location of your water intake in rivers, are now being impacted by rising sea level and saltwater intrusion. And you compound that with aging infrastructure, as Dr. Channon was describing, and increasing structural vulnerability of those infrastructure due to climate change impact are all very real. And of course, you know, really difficult to address when you are further limited by your capacity to finance capital works. Often just to keep pace with the demand of increasing urbanization, let alone the increasing vulnerability to climate change impact. So we heard a bit about some of the difficulties of small island development states. And in that previous seminar, we then heard about some of the initiatives and strategies of Singapore, quite a different small island state. But one that we could learn a lot from in terms of their strategies and their ambition. Their strategies in terms of diversifying their water sources is one that we all could learn about and ensuring a level of drought proofing by accessing multiple sources of water. And I dare say, to take it one step further, and delivering that water on a fit-for-purpose basis, that perhaps there is no need to have all water treated to drinking standards to be provided, and that we could actually be even further in our innovation by looking at fit for purpose, access of multiple sources and delivery to use at multiple water quality requirements. Singapore is still now refocusing on coastal protection, and there are quite a lot of innovations that we see in terms of their use of nature-based solutions and hybrid green and grey infrastructure. And finally, in that previous seminar, we've heard from Professor Ming, and she provided us with an interesting perspective of the role of digitization in fostering greater resilience in urban water management. Through examples, she was able to demonstrate in a project she undertook in Shanghai in China, the role of data analytics and the emerging digital technology for real-time monitoring of environmental conditions, forecasting, decision support, and ultimately real-time control of multifunction infrastructure. So that was a bit of a very diverse perspective of what would make a city resilient and smart.
That was a real eye-opener, wasn't it, Tony? Because often when you hear the term smart, and the mind automatically leads towards digital, but we heard three very non-digital, well, partly digital in the advanced analytics from China, but for the small island states, it was about being smarter with how they're financing infrastructure. And in Singapore, it was around the water-sensitive urban design. I think that was a real take-home, is that smart means different things to different people, and that there wasn't a one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah, I think it's often way too simplistic to relate smart to simply digital technology or digitization, although, of course, it has a very important role in what we do in strengthening the resilience of cities. But in the end of the day, it really, the key word for me is resilient, and how do you go about organizing ourselves in underpinning city resilience. Now, that's what makes it smart.
I look at your CV, Tony. You've got a wonderful history and expertise, and particularly of interest is the work in biomimicry that you've done in the past. So I'm keen to learn more of where you see the role of nature-based solutions in help solving some of the challenges that climate change will present.
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting development. I think it was around 2018. That the global community led by UN, UN Water, really came with the realization that for too long we have developed cities by exploiting ecosystem services of nature to the point whereby most cities find themselves absence of a lot of the natural capital. What I mean by exploiting is in the simplest form. You know, we discharge our wastewater into the environment and expect that nature would look after it, would assimilate that waste, neutralize them, and so on. We extract water from our catchments with the expectation that the natural capital, the natural forests will have that cleansing function to ensure that our water supply remains clean. And I think now there is a realization that the natural capital and the ecosystem services they provide is not something that we can take for granted, but it's something that we have to try and nurture and harness in a sustainable way. And that they do not need to be designed out in a conventional urban design perspective. Just look at drainage. And a good example of that, again, I draw my attention to the very impressive work that the city of Singapore has undertaken in now reintroducing nature solutions back into their highly urbanized infrastructure, you know, the conversion of concrete drains back to waterways, and in that process actually start to introduce the role of nature in cleansing water. And of course, we know that Singapore is harvesting every last drop of stormwater. And to do that, you do need to ensure that the stormwater quality is cleansed such that they can be harnessed and used as an important water resource. The work that I do, and this is in the 1990s, way before nature-based solution became popular or acknowledged as an important contribution to sustainable cities. I sort of started to get interested in this whole relationship of the hydrology of wetlands and how the hydrology of a wetland supports its ecology, and how the ecology of a wetland is what makes all of those ecosystem services such as water cleansing works. By understanding that relationship, we were able to then think about what are some of the key processes that we need to preserve if we were to introduce systems such as constructed wetlands into our cities. That, for me, was the beginning of my take on biomimicry, is how do we preserve the key natural processes, or how do we mimic those processes of hydrology and ecology such that we can create systems in the urban form that provides those ecosystem services, whether it be for water cleansing or for flow detentions, and now more recently for microclimate enhancements. So the understanding of biomimicry and the processes allow us to now embed nature-based solutions into our urban form. So that's where it came from, Michael.
Yeah, but it's certainly, and love to see how your research and how that evolves in coming years. Tony, we often see a lot of focus on the chronic effects of climate change, the rising temperatures and sea levels, and ways to mitigate the you know, increasing trends in both. I'm thinking towards we're seeing, you know, some of the extreme events, and these are the more acute effects of climate change, and the large rainfall events. We saw a major cloudburst event in New York recently, bushfires and other floods. How do we build smarter and more resilient systems to manage the what I call the acute effects of climate change?
It's interesting you sort of raise this whole notion of how does a city cope with really acute events, and there'll be more of it. And there are chronic events such as drought as well, and there'll be more of that too. And in my reflection to that, I formed the view that the resilience is there are two sides to the resilient coin, if you like. You know, that there is, of course, the importance of infrastructure and the resilience of the infrastructure to be able to accommodate quite a wide range of operating conditions that it now needs to operate. But I really want to touch on the other side of the coin, and that is this whole notion of social resilience, the capacity of our community to be able to respond to acute events, the capacity of our city government and emergency services to do the same. And I'll give you an example that there's been a lot of development in technology, digital technology, in terms of data analytics and combinations of different models to be able to now forecast, even nowcast, acute events. But it's equally important for the community and government emergency services to know what to do with that kind of information. It is important for us to be able to predict, yes, water level at this bridge is going to get to X meters. But it is equally important for communities to understand what that means in relation to my home, to my location. If it's 6 meters at the end of Grant Street, well, what does that mean? And what do I need to do in terms of my preparedness for those events? Broadly, water literacy is really important. That community needs to understand how they are exposed to those challenges. Equally, government, city government, need to be able to organize themselves in terms of preparing for events, how they would respond during events, and then what are the systems they need to put in place for the type of recovery following events. They all could be grouped into what I refer to as social resilience. And so it really is important for us when thinking about a resilient cities to invest in both the building of social resilience as well as the building of infrastructure resilience in terms of the robustness of our infrastructure, the multifunction of real-time control and how that could actually limit exposure and damage of acute events. The same could be said with non-acute events, you know, the droughts that creeps up on you, and our ability to progressively change our water consumption patterns, our behavior, and our ability to reuse water. All of that is really a reflection of our social resilience. I have come across many cities in the developed world, particularly, where our quest to build stronger resilience, to control environment, often inadvertently design out whatever social resilience that we may have in those communities. I have come across cities whereby communities have this clear expectation that government and infrastructure is going to provide all the protection that is needed. And that is fine, but as we enter into a period of uncertainty, a period whereby we are even uncertain about what a 100-year event actually means, we actually need to now re-engage with our community for them to understand how they need to respond to different situations, how they need to actually embrace the notion that we are entering an uncertain era, and that they do have a role to play in that. Interestingly, in my travels to the developing world, I see incredible social resilience. People are adaptive, people are doing what they can, people are themselves actually understanding and reusing water in a multiple way because they actually understand the scarcity of water. And my reflection on that is, they could do with a bit more infrastructure in terms of investment. But in our quest to invest in infrastructure in those communities, we shouldn't forget to continue to nurture the high social resilience that those communities already have in that sense. So, I come back to the notion that resilience is not just about putting more money into infrastructure. It is important infrastructure, but how the infrastructure operate can be further enhanced through digital technology and smart operation. But the other side of the coin is really that community need to embrace the fact that social resilience ultimately could be their key component of addressing the type of uncertainties that we are dealing with.
I think I'll pick up on a term you used earlier about now casting. I really like the use of that word. I think we live in uncertain times, and it's, as you pointed out, it's being increasingly difficult to forecast the future. We can't rely on the events of the past to help us forecast the future. We're seeing, previously one in 100-year events happening, another one in 10 events. We don't even know what a one in 100-year event really looks like. But at the same time, that's forecasting in the same time as the now casting, you know, providing a response to an event. And we've seen some pretty good recent examples in bushfires and floods where we haven't been able to do that. And that's a big part of that social resilience. Mm. And really, when we talk about mitigating the effects of climate change, it's about being helping communities to respond and respond in a way that minimises, you know, the damage on those communities themselves. Now casting, it's quite a pertinent word.
Yeah. The emergence of artificial intelligence, the emergence of remote sensing are all now giving us the capacity to now cast.
Fantastic. I love it. Tony, you've just returned from COP28 in Dubai. So what were your expectations of what were you expecting prior to going? What was achieved? Can you share some of your reflections on your attendance of COP28 in Dubai?
Yeah, this COP28, we see the emergence of such factors as health, food, and water elevated to a focal points for climate action. And it really is a reflection of the fact that we are globally now finding the need to not so much pivot, but the need to take into serious consideration climate adaptation actions. I think for a long time, the focus have always been in climate mitigation. And climate mitigation, you would imagine it's quite a narrow definition in the sense that if we reduce our emission, we are on our way to achieving some of the climate mitigation goals. The realization that no matter how much climate mitigation work we do, climate change has now come before us. It is now happening. We are now experiencing the type of acute events that we were talking about previously, and that there was a need for us to actually start to also think about investing in and developing strategies for climate adaptation. The minute we move to that focus, we suddenly realize that climate adaptation is not about simply limiting the kind of energy sources that we use. Climate impacts cuts across many, many sectors. And as I mentioned previously, water has a prominent feature in many climate impacts, floods, droughts, water quality, and so on. And so does health. And so does food. And so with the shift to climate adaptation, those issues became elevated for serious discussion and consideration. And it is in that context that I was very excited and delighted to be invited by the Australian Water Partnership to join their delegation to COP28 with the expectation that water can play a very significant role in enabling climate adaptation initiatives. So I went to COP with that expectation, and to some degree, it has been a bit of a disappointment when we see how overwhelming it can be when you have 70,000 people converge into an area, all of which are advocating for their discipline being the key to addressing climate action. And the reality is that they are all relevant. The biggest challenge in our climate adaptation space is how do we integrate across all of those sectors. The big challenge for the water sector, in fact, is in itself trying to understand the integration of different water frameworks and initiatives. We heard discussions about water in a circular economy, very important in terms of the integration of different water streams and the reuse of water in that regard. But I asked the question really of what is the purpose of enabling a circular economy within the water space without bringing into the discussion all the other nexus, particularly in food, particularly in understanding water and energy nexus, particularly in understanding that as the energy sector starts to move to alternative energy, hydrogen, for instance, there is an impact or an implication on the water resources. And therefore, the water sector really do need to now think about how a circular economy and the water nexus need to come together. There was a lot of those discussions, but I would say that there is equally a lot of noise in that sector, to the point whereby I didn't think that the water sector really got their act together to become a significant voice within the negotiations and discussions that was going on, if you like, in parallel in COP28. So I was there to be engaging with the water sector and the aim with other sectors like the food sector and the health sector to really impress upon those sectors the enabling role that water has. I'm not sure that we have been effective in really promoting the notion of water as an enabler for a whole range of different climate actions. We hear the conclusion of COP28, the recognition of the need to transition away from fossil fuel, and that invariably means the increase in alternative energy that will have a water impact that we need to be part of that discussion in. And then there is the climate adaptation in terms of looking at strategies for adapting to climate impact, and that is the floods and the droughts and the deteriorating water quality and the loss of food production and the impact on community health because of the changing hydrology that some of those communities are. And I am not sure that, again, we have a prominent role in the discussions across those sectors. We're great in talking amongst ourselves in the water sector, and we're almost preaching to the converted, and yet there is not enough strategic actions in water permeating through the discussions in all of those other sectors. So my sense is that there is a great enthusiasm of the recognition of climate adaptation as almost an equal partner in climate action to climate mitigation. And there's a lot of funding that goes with it to help mainly developing countries to strengthen their adaptation capacity. But the space of climate impact in itself are quite fragmented and quite silo, rather than actually looking at how a combination of different initiatives can come and address some of those climate impacts. So I think that there is a I come back more convinced than ever that the water sector need to step up in their leadership role in the discussions of climate actions, but we need to step up in a way that enables a whole bunch of other climate impacts to be addressed. And I come back to this whole notion of food security and health and alternative energy. We need to step up in that sector in addition to organizing ourselves to understand the integration of our water management to deliver better adaptation to climate impacts on droughts and floods and deteriorating water quality and urban heat in that regard. So we do have two really important functions: the climate impact as it is manifested through water, and the climate impact that water can enable solutions to, and that might be in the health and the food and the energy sector.
On one hand, I guess you were buoyant by the attendance. I mean, 70,000 people converging to talk about climate resilience and adaptation must be encouraging. But what I'm hearing is we've still got some way to go. There's some technical barriers to overcome, but I'm understanding it's largely institutional. It's governments. It's working together. It's working across sectors and it's working across continents.
You know, I'll give an example that, Australia has its renewable energy policy, and at COP actually launched their health policy, and water is virtually silent in those policies. And therefore, our effectiveness in COP, in some sense, is not just at the conference, it's the way that we engage with different sectors leading up to COP to make sure that in the discussions, we are embedded in those discussions in other sectors. Our leadership role is equally in how we influence our respective government to ensure that they are aware of the role of water in many of their strategies that seemingly had nothing to do with water. If we can't influence it at that point, in some sense, there's little point going to COP because, you know, the programs are designed, have been developed, the multiple sessions, and there are many sessions, you know, the speaking engagement, the points that are being made, the messaging, they all pretty much develop by the time COP comes around. So if we're not there preparing for those events, then I think we are largely ineffective.
And in the water sector, it seems that we're a little bit siloed. Is that?
Yeah. And sometimes I wonder whether there is a need for a water pavilion. Perhaps there is, because you know, climate impact are also often manifested in water. So yeah, the water pavilion perhaps is important. But one of the things I find is that when I go to the sessions in the water pavilion, I am speaking to the converted. We are all furiously agreeing about, you know, the importance of integrated water, the importance of nature-based solution. But there's a whole bunch of other pavilions out there that are not aware of this. And this is where we need to get our impacts across.
Exactly. Tony, we're going to take this conversation to Toronto next year, the World Water Congress in August. And one of the things we want to bring to life is look at some of the case studies that have worked. You mentioned Singapore before. Who do you see as the exemplars in building smart and sustainable and resilient cities?
Look, there are a number of cities now that are emerging, that are transitioning. And more importantly, in my travels, I find that they have been able to identify what would be their catalyst for transition. You know, you may find that Singapore, their catalyst for transition was in fact the need to get away from their very acute dependency on water from external sources, keeping their water security. So their driver for transitioning was to achieve multiple sources of water, and when they got to stormwater as a resource, they then start to look at the role of nature-based solutions for cleansing water, and that's how they transition. There are other parts of the world whereby they felt that their driver, because they are in the early stages of development, that their driver is in policy and how policy reform can actually foster greater private sector participation in their transformation. And there's a lot that we can sort of learn from that perspective as well. And then there's a city, and the city that I know very well, the city of Kunshan, whereby in the space of 10 years, they've completely transformed their city simply because of the huge infrastructure investment that went into the city for their high-speed train, for their freeway. and they integrated through those road corridors a nature-based corridor as part of that, and through that introduced greater flood resilience, greater ability to cleanse and harvest stormwater for their use, and also to create greater biodiversity because of the connectedness of their corridors that they are combining, both, you know, the road transport corridors together with their nature corridor in the space that they have. What would be really interesting in Toronto is actually to hear from the city officials and their planners and their engineering departments on their journey. And I hope that we would be able to identify a number of cities whereby they all have different starting point in their transition, what catalyzed their transition, but how they are approaching an endpoint that is really about all of them. Great policy, great infrastructure, smart communities, all coming together, but coming from different pathways. I hope that Toronto can actually provide audience with some really real examples. You know, enough of talking about academic theory, enough of talking about pilot studies, but actually look at how a city actually transformed itself, and what were the pathways and what were the catalysts to those transformation.
And I can hardly wait, and looking forward to continuing the conversation in Toronto in August next year. So, okay, you've got the final word. So putting your future focus glasses on, what 10, 15 years time from now, what would a smart, resilient city look like?
I would like to think that, you know, a smart, resilient city is one where there is a greater level of, and I'm using this term sort of guardedly, a greater level of optimization of how water is being used, conserved, preserved, both for the built environment and the natural environment. And that word of optimizing is optimizing the value of water as a commodity, as a influencing of culture, as the means of connecting people back to nature, as a means of enhancing the biodiversity and the ecological footprint of cities, and all of that. And as you walk into a future city or many future cities, you would see their own unique brand of what resilience and smart actually mean to those cities. And it's a reflection of the strength of the community, their culture, the strength of government in enabling a constant learning and transformation of doing better, great biodiversity that ultimately influence the microclimate. I'm talking about a bubble, aren't I? Perhaps I am, but I like to think that it is that whole coming together of an ecosystem that provides a new equilibrium of how people and nature can coexist in an incredibly harmonious way. That would be what I like to see 15 years from now.
What a great thought to leave off on, Tony. Look, we're privileged in Australia to have, I believe, the world's greatest thought leader on the subject as part of the Australian but the global water industry. The work that you've done and will continue to do around building more resilient, sustainable, water-sensitive cities, we're privileged to have you as part of this IWAA podcast. I've learned a lot, Tony. Climate change and it's an intractable issue. It's going to require a lot of work and a lot of cross-sectoral work, as well as between governments and countries another. We're on a journey, and we're very lucky to have you taking us on that journey. So with that, I thank you for your time, the generosity of your time and your insights, and appreciate you being part of this conversation.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for the opportunities and your kind words. I do appreciate them very much. Thank you.
Glad to catch up. Thank you, Tony.
Okay.
Cheers. Bye for now.